Shalom and welcome back to our discussions of Iyunei Omanut, looking at Rav Kook's teachings and how they shed light on our work in Jewish education, particularly as it relates to creativity and the arts. For those of you that have been following along with us, we're pleased to let you know that we have now made available on CD the previous series of discussions. And if you contact us by email at atid@atid.org, we'll be very happy to provide you with a copy of those. But it is, of course, available on our website at www.atid.org. Today, I'm sitting with Rabbi Yedidia Sinclair and Rabbi Chaim Bravender, as always, and we're talking about the question of whether or not aesthetics is a religious value, are a religious value, and if so, why? And we were talking about that very well-known story about Rav Kook visiting the National Gallery in London, which was subsequently written up in the Jewish Chronicle and is also available from a link on this page. And Rav Kook there refers to encountering a Rembrandt painting and says, ah, Rembrandt was a tzaddik, because he was able to somehow see this divine light and turn it into a painting like this. So if that's the case, what do these tzaddikim, such as Rembrandt or any other great artists, choose your own favorite, what do they know, or what do they see, or how do they see, that enables them to bring out beauty in the world? I think it's important to state that famous little quip of Rav Kook about Rembrandt should not be overemphasized, as it often is. But today, in looking at a piece from Orot HaKodesh, Volume 3, in the neighborhood of page 306, the text, of course, is, as always, available to follow along, we're going to try to uncover, scratch away at the surface of some of the theological underpinnings that led Rav Kook to make such a comment. We will, as always, turn to our friend Rabbi Sinclair to help us in deciphering Rav Kook, and then move on to our discussion.
Thanks, Rabbi Sachs. It's good to be back. Is beauty a religious value? It doesn't seem to me obvious that it is, at least in a Jewish framework. The Torah says in many places that goodness is important. The Torah says, Vasita yashar v'tov, but doesn't say Vasita et hayofi v'tov. The Torah talks about truth as a value. Doesn't talk about beauty. But Keats says beauty is truth and truth is beauty, but that doesn't seem to be obviously the Torah's view. Rav Kook certainly thought it was, and the passage we're going to look at today brings out why he thought it was. But before we look at it, well, why do we think it is? What is beauty a religious value, and if so, why?
I imagine that humanity, like however you define it, is a religious value that religion wants to perfect the human response, or the human reaction to the world in which he lives, which is partly this world and partly some notion of a transcendental state. And it may be that beauty is a connector in some way, that you can make something that has no neshama, I mean an inanimate object that has no neshama, like you can paint a flower poorly, and then you can paint a flower such that you stand in awe of what the artist has produced, so that beauty is the measure of the transcendental in the olam hazeh, in the this worldliness of things, And as such is like everything that leads to the transcendental, or that leads me or gives me an opening or brings me closer to the notion of God. I would imagine that beauty is positive. I would add one thing, that there's no doubt that even though the Torah doesn't say it specifically, the Mishkan seems to have been built in a special and especially beautiful way. The Rambam points out that the Begadim of the Kohen Gadol, which were devised as L'chavod u'L'tiferes, that this notion of Kavod and Tiferes could be learned from non-Jewish kings in the world, like the king of Persia, who had certainly, according to Megillat Esther, a very special idea of what beauty is. So it's not true that it's entirely absent from basic Torah considerations. Nevertheless, it's hard to pinpoint, because beauty is, to a certain extent, subjective. And so it's hard to... But I'm not sure that that matters. Maybe that is a great boon, that everybody can find their entree point into a more transcendental kind of appreciation of things. And maybe the fact that beauty is hard to define, hard to connect, or hard to pinpoint, maybe that religiously is an advantage, because it gives, I mean, it's like nigunim, you know, not everybody likes the same nigun, but everybody could like very much the nigun that he likes. Mm-hmm. And so so you have this wide range which enables you to connect to the notion of beauty, even though you may not be scholarly about it or very academic about it. Nevertheless, it's there, and I think as such it's something that the Torah certainly might have considered.
Hmm. Nevertheless, I mean, you can go into certain religious neighborhoods in Jerusalem today and they have very fine, refined qualities about them. You can be forgiven for thinking that the ugliness is a value when you go.
Well, it may be, but, you know, they're always contrasting elements that determine the way we act and live and do. But in fact, you know, beauty has its danger. It's also misleading. It's also... uproots you from what might be considered the more important in notions of Torah study, etc., and so there might be certain people might conclude that there are advantages to less beauty, or less ostentatious presentations of self, but that doesn't mean, I don't think that proves that beauty is not a value that the Torah has. It's just that we're not often able to control it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, eating is, you know, the Torah, according to the Ramban says that eating is something you should do in a measured way, right? Not overdo it. And yet we have Shabbos, we have Yontif, so all these things demand balance, and I'm sure that beauty is somehow fits into that category of search for balance.
Hmm. Well, there's no doubt that the halakha, the Torah, has an ambivalence, even a suspicion of beauty, aesthetics, the aesthetic experience, because it's so subjective, and because perhaps it's among the most subjective of all experiences.
Where is this suspicion?
I mean, one senses it. I can't point to a pasuk, but insofar as the halakha is, one senses a suspicion and uneasiness with subjective experience, and a desire to concretize subjective, to preserve subjective, not to obliterate it, but to preserve it and encase it within an objective experience. I know that Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky, Zichrono Lebracha, wrote about this within the Rambam's teachings a great deal. If you look at the sixth chapter of Twersky's Introduction to the Code of Maimonides, his magnum opus, that whole sixth chapter, which I think is called Philosophy and Law, talks about this, the dialectic between the subjective and the objective. I recently wrote on this in a monograph that was published entitled "Spiritualizing Halachic Education" and what that experience kind of means within the contemporary world of teaching. And there's no doubt that much of the halachic project is to balance these two experiences. And insofar as the aesthetic experience, the aesthetic in the original sense of the sensual, not sexual, but sensual, the senses interacting and impacting on the senses is something which is so unique for each person, and which is interpreted differently. And even the notion of b'tam v'reach ein l'dvakeach, even though we're the people that like to l'dvakeach on also on everything, that this is something about which there's caution.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the question about the whole. I mean, could you imagine other people sitting around in discussion like, is beauty a value?
No.
The whole premise of our discussion belies this.
Yeah.
Or the whole premise of our discussion, indicates this ambivalence.
Yeah. Right. It indicates that it's not clear. We think that it is a value. We're not sure why. See why we cook things. Why? So we're looking at Ur HaKodesh, Volume 3, page Shinvav, 306. And the passage is called Tiferet Tzadikim Muflaim. Tiferet, meaning beauty or glory, of the wondrous Tzadikim. Now, it's important to point out that when Rav Kook talks about Tzadikim, and this passage is one of a series of several in which he's talking about Tzadikim, he's, among other people, he's probably talking about himself. Now you could say, oh, how can he be talking about himself? Well, he's not directly talking about himself. Rav Kook was certainly a great anav. But when you look at passages in which Rav Kook talks about tzaddikim in the third person, and passages in his spiritual diaries where he talks about his own experience, there's a great deal of overlap between the experiences which he's giving witness to and those which the tzaddikim, which he's describing, have. Smadar Sherlow just wrote a PhD thesis at Borulet, tracing this very thoroughly and showing that when Rav Kook talks about tzaddikim, whoever else he's talking about, he's drawing on his own experience.
And that's based upon the Shmona Kvatzim.
Yeah, it's based upon comparing passages in Shmona Kvatzim with Ur HaKodesh.
Shmona Kvatzim, which is explicitly autobiographical.
Yeah, in Shmona Kvatzim there's a lot more first-person material than made it into the Ur HaKodesh. So for example, Shin Zayin, he talks about the Tzaddik Elyon. In the first sentence he says that the true holy Tzaddikim unite within them all opposites and all conflicting kinds of goodness in the world. I mean, that you could take that as a summary of Rav Kook's whole life work. He was outstanding in trying to bring together things which other people took as contradictory. Religious and secular, structure and spontaneity, art and halacha. Rav Kook tried to unite all these things. Just in that sentence, he's talking about tzaddikim in the third person, but that was Rav Kook's life. So when we look back at Shin Vav, and here we have Kook talking about tzaddikim and muflaim, so be aware of the fact that this is probably drawing on his own life. The previous page, Shin Hei, he talks about tzaddikim v'avad olam hazeh. And he talks about tzaddikim who are so bound to the world of holiness that olam hazeh seems to empty out of significance for them. They're so involved in the world of kedusha that this physical world comes to be unimportant, less important to them. And they have a connection through it to tefillah, through learning, and the this worldly subjects which tefillah and Talmud Torah deal with, but that's their connection to this world, but really their thought for somewhere else. Shin Vav needs to be read as a continuation of that, I think. So this is what Rav Cook says. He says, "Hatzadikim ha-muflaim she'ein olam hazeh tofes etzlam makom mitzad gvulav v'shiflotav v'tzimtzumot, davka heim mokirim et ha-olam u'machabdim oto." So here's a paradoxical statement. The wondrous tzadikim for whom olam hazeh does not hold very much value for them because of its limitedness compared to the spiritual realm, davka those tzadikim, they are able to value and appreciate olam hazeh. It appears contradictory, paradoxical. Why? Mipnei sheheim ro'im bo olam elyon, ziv tahor mimakor hachayim, v'yafio v'tovo mitalev be'iluyim gedolim. Because, Rav Kook says, these tzadikim, they're able to perceive and appreciate the pure spiritual glow and the beauty which it confers on this world. The Rav Kook is saying that because these tzaddikim are not that interested really in Olam HaZeh for its own sake, are able to perceive the spiritual light which is shines through Olam HaZeh and through the phenomena of Olam HaZeh, actually, these tzaddikim are able to appreciate Olam HaZeh in a very fine way. V'hagashat ha-noam v'hayofi shebo megadelet etzlam begodel kol kedusha v'adina elyona. Ad sheheinam tamid chayim chayim meleim sheyesh bahem kol shikui ha-leshed shel kol ha-na'ot ha-estetiot. The difficult sentence. I think Rav Kook is saying that the feelings of pleasantness and of yofi and of beauty which they feel because they perceive the spiritual glow which permeates Olam HaZeh, that shows them to appreciate the Kedusha in every aspect of Olam HaZeh. And therefore they have, as Rav Kook puts it, they're soaked with the sap of aesthetic pleasure. The beauty, the spiritual beauty which permeates Olam HaZeh just fills them with a sense of aesthetic delight. And there I think you already see the underpinnings for our famous Rembrandt story. How could Rembrandt say that? How could Rav Kook say that Rembrandt was a tzaddik, and that he saw the Or HaGadol of tzaddikim l'olam haba? Because Rembrandt, according to Rav Kook, was one of these people. He was attached to the spiritual dimension of life, Rav Kook thinks, which enabled him to see the spiritual light permeating all of physical existence and give expression to it in his art. All right, till now? Yeah. Okay.
Where does it come from?
What, the light?
No, this idea.
I think Rav Kook's going to go on and say that. In a word, I think the answer is Kabbalah, and with my very, very limited understanding of Kabbalah, we'll try and make a little bit of sense of that.
But there is a kind of simple, straightforward possibility.
Yeah.
And that is that a world that was created under the banner of Vayavdeo.
Yeah.
Like as a secondary act, there was a distinction between the heavens and the earth.
Yeah.
That might imply, and the Tower of Babel, which is, there was an assumption that people had that you could reunite the heavens and the earth for better and for worse. And that assumption might be correct, in the sense that someone who is very perceptive could see the world without that vayavdev, could see, say, God in Olam Hazeh. So if you see God in Olam Hazeh, it's heaven. I mean, what's the difference between heaven and earth? So that capacity is implied by the way the world was created.
Who assumes that you can reunite heaven and earth?
The people in Migdal Bavel. They thought that they could overcome the distinction and, you know, make their presence known in heaven.
And they don't get a very good rap in the Torah, do they?
No, they don't, because they wanted their intention was bad, or their goal was not acceptable, but the methodology was possible. They said, we belong there. We have as much right to there as we have to here. And so they did not accept that the Vayavdel was an innate limitation. They felt that they could be in heaven just as much as they can be in earth. Which I guess means also that someone on earth could see heaven. I mean, it's created by God, so what's the difference? The fact that it produces many distractions doesn't mean that in essence you can't see it. So if a person is thinking about God all the time, I mean, it's not so unreasonable to imagine that he sees the God of the creation more than he sees the Vayavdel of the creation. I mean, it's there. It's all there.
So Mefushman Migdal Bavel would say that the goal of reuniting heaven and earth was fine, just the way they went about it was wrong, or the motivation was wrong?
No, I don't mean desire. I said the desire itself was probably based on some Havamina that made sense. If you say to somebody, let's build a tower into heaven, you wouldn't get many supporters, because we don't see that as a possibility, but they did see it as a possibility.
Right.
The question is, what was their Havamina? Somehow that they either that they belonged in heaven, or that heaven was not any different than earth in some way. So the Havamina could have been, if not correct, but at least plausible in some way.
So today, if you would say, let's meditate or take hallucinogenic drugs the whole deal, they're working on the same Havamina.
I don't know. I think if you go and you walk at it, you look at a tree and you say, that's God, maybe that's a similar Havamina. Hallucinatory drugs means just, I want to get to Olam Haba quick. So I disconnect myself from Olam Hazeh. But here I think what he's saying is that if a person is so sensitive to divinity, that there's no reason that God should not be present every place he looks. That person. So the world that he sees is a much finer world than anybody else sees. Because everybody else sees Vayavdel. And this world is a place where people sin and people are, you know, don't act properly, etc. Whereas in heaven, certainly that's not the case with the angels. That's what everybody sees. But the person who sees beyond that sees light, sees the light of God's creation, of God's purpose, of some sort of a plan. All of that is possible for the people with the aesthetic sense. Or whatever it is, he mentions that here, right? Hanaot estetio. Also, shikui aleshet, the strange lashon, the water of fat somehow, you know, like the great displeasure you should imagine, but he uses the word leshet, which is a word that's used to describe the man. And that was what man was. Man was pleasure. But it was Olam Haba. Because
Lechem and Hashemayim.
It was Lechem and Hashemayim. It didn't go through the bowels in a normal way. It produced whatever pleasure you were interested in producing. So that maybe that connection is also, if not, you know, hidden there, not so hidden, but should be noted.
Yeah, very much. So he goes on to say, "V'chushei hem aruchanim afilu b'yachas la'atochen ha'aseti ha'ragil v'hakarat ha'yofi shebamarot, shebashira, shebaseide, shebamedina, shebamusa, shebachol erech mitkaflim v'kiflaim adirim ad shehem hem hen ha'makorot ha'yofi v'hasidur v'hachayim." So he says that these spiritual senses, which come from its appreciation of the spiritual world and connection to it, that even in relation to what Cook calls the regular aesthetic sense, in the way one appreciates beauty in drawings, in poetry, in Medina, whatever exactly Cook means by that, and in Musa, in all the this worldly expressions of aesthetic value, these tzaddikim also are able to appreciate them in a particularly intense way, and they're doubled and redoubled until they themselves become sources of beauty and of order in life. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the Heim Heinam is referring to, but my reading is that Cook is saying that these tzaddikim and gedolim who are plugged in to these supernal aesthetic sense of beauty, they see a aesthetic beauty particularly acutely in this worldly expressions of it, whether poetry or art or architecture or whatever, and so they become, those art forms become independent sources of beauty for the tzaddik who looks at them. Sound like a fair reading?
I think so.
Yeah. So then Ralph Cook takes a very interesting twist. He says, "Ha'olam mizdaher b'yofiyo u'mitaleh b'tifato al yedei hashba'at ziv nishmatam." Saying the whole world is given a kind of a beauty and splendor and is raised up by the tiferet, let's leave that untranslated, of the influence of these tzaddikim souls. So these tzaddikim who have this connection to the world of spiritual beauty, they, just their existence and their sense of this connection lifts up, raises up the whole world. And then, Cook says, "V'chol ba'alei umaniyot shebechochmot hayafot mitalim umitandim umitbarachim al yedei hashba'atam." An extraordinary revealing sentence, I think, in terms of what Ralph Cook thought he was doing in terms of hanging out with all these artists and writers, as he did. Because he's saying that all these artists and people involved in Chachmat HaYafot, they all get raised up and purified and blessed by their connection with the Tzaddikim Muflaim, or in this case with Rav Cook, if we accept that this is Rav Cook talking about his own experience. And this seems to be borne out by the biographical stories we see about Rav Cook's involvement with these people. That time and again we see that Rav Cook seems to be very concerned to raise up and purify and guide the activities of the writers and artists in his vicinity, towards the direction of Kedusha. Many examples you could give of that. And Rav Kutz, he seems to be seeing himself as a source of because he, if he has this sense of connection to the spiritual world, the spiritual beauty, as a source through which these artists and writers could reflect and connect to that dimension of beauty. Ki heim ba'atzmam, as the tzaddikim, hinam shruyim b'sfirat ha'tiferet ha'elokit. Because they themselves, and here I think he means the tzaddikim, they dwell in the sphira, and here is the Kabbalistic reference is explicit, the sphira of divine tiferet. So, what does Rav Kook mean by that? Well, indeed, the basic books on Kabbalah will tell you that the sphira of tiferet, which is often translated as beauty, is a kind of a synthesis or a balance between, on the one hand, chesed, the quality of giving, of spontaneity, of generosity, without limits, on the one hand, and gvura, on the other hand. Gvura being the quality of form, of structure, of limitation, of withdrawal, of din. The opposite of chesed. And tiferet is the perfect balance between them. And seems to me that Ralph Cook is saying what is borne out by the testimony of many artists, that art is about getting the right balance between those two things. If you just have a mastery of structure and form and technique, or you just have an overflowing, spontaneous, creative soul, you're not going to be a great artist in either case. But great art comes from having struck the balance between those two things, having mastered form and technique on the one hand, and using that as a channel for the spontaneous ideas and impressions that come to you. That's what an artist has to have. And so I think Ralph Cook is saying that the great tzaddikim, who in some sense rooted in that quality of tiferet, of divine balance between chesed and gvura, they can be a powerful source of inspiration for real artists. Because this sphira of tiferet, a kolelet b'chativa echad kol hadra shamayim v'aretz. It unifies in one chativa, in one package, or that doesn't seem to be the right word, the all the beauty of heaven and earth. V'hatiferet holechet u'mikpashetet al kol ha'yitzur. And through the influence of these tzaddikim, this tiferet goes and spreads out on all creation. Va'al kol ma'aseihem, and all of their actions, va'al kol rachshei libam v'netiyoteihem. And all the thoughts of their heart and inclinations. And I think now he's talking about the thoughts of their heart and inclinations of the artist as a result of their connection to the tzaddik. For all melech v'yofiyo holechu mitgale aleihem. And the light of the king and its beauty goes and is revealed in them. So if you read this passage as Ralph Cook talking in some way about his own experiences, it's very revealing about what he thought his role was in encouraging and promoting the revival of art in his generation. Through this connection of spiritual beauty, which we take it he felt he had, he could be a source through which the artists who he knew could similarly reflect that in their work, through their connection with him. That seem a fair reading? And if so, does it make any sense? Mm-hmm.
We start from the word Tiferes, There's no doubt that the word Tiferes has many special meanings, including, as you said, a Kabbalistic meaning. And
well, Cook says it alludes to explicitly. He says, Sfirat HaTiferet.
Right.
Yeah.
But the word Tiferet is also a regular word.
Yeah.
Which demands an aesthetic appreciation of things.
Yeah.
But how do we identify what is Tiferet and what's not Tiferet? So Cook assumes, and in the previous paragraph as well, that we have that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
We have the capacity to make poetry, we have the capacity for architecture, we have the capacity to distinguish not just functionality, but also beauty. I mean, it's a capacity that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question, our question is, does that make it a religious capacity? So you could say something simple and say that everything that man could do is in some way a product of divine input.
Mm-hmm.
So anything good or neutral is probably reasonably associated with creation and with God.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something special about this capacity that we have for beauty?
Mm-hmm.
It may be because of Tiferes, the sphere of Tiferes, maybe because of something else. There's no doubt that Rav Kook associates a beauty with a religious activity,
mm-hmm.
like distinguishing and finding and identifying things that are beautiful, is something that God wants us to do, as evidence, as I mentioned earlier, the Mishkan and the Big Day Kahuna and other things. So if God wants us to do it, then the way you define a religious act is that it has not only a something develops your personality, it's something you do, but it has an effect. It's special in that it affects the world. Like you could do a mitzvah and it won't affect anything, but you could do a mitzvah and it will affect everything around you. Similarly, I think beauty has the same capacity. Even though it's an appreciation of the world that God created, or as I say, oh, I discovered it. God created a world that has beauty in it. That's a discovery that I make. Having made that discovery, that is going to have an effect on the way man finishes creation or deals with creation, right? I have to build things in the creation which don't contradict creation. Like I have to build a building on a mountain or on a hill and a hilltop. So I want to build it in a way that is not contradictory to creation, but in some way is appreciated by creation. And the key to that relationship is called beauty. If my result can be classified as beautiful, that I've done the right thing. So if I'm an architect, that I'm able to produce a world with more beauty in it, then as a person who has this charge from heaven, not to mess it up, but to enhance it. So beauty is the name of the key to enhancing and not messing it up. And that's what makes it an essentially religious activity. The same thing is true about Shira, about poetry, the same thing is true about literature, the same thing is true about everything that could be classified as being beautiful, even sometimes math and science. You know, mathematicians talk about what they do as being beautiful. You know, their hypothesis or the equations that they use to work out ideas, they see in them a certain kind of beauty which is hard for non-mathematicians to understand, but that's the word of choice nonetheless, mm-hmm. which means to me that I, a person in the world, am doing somehow what God wants of me, which is to enhance the created world, mm-hmm. to make it more something. And the word that designates the more is beauty, because what God, whatever God created is beautiful by definition.
Mm-hmm.
So I can either mess it up by making garbage dumps,
mm-hmm.
or enhance it by building the Taj Mahal. So if I build Taj Mahals, then I'm okay. It's almost fulfilling a religious obligation. And then the ability to recognize this is what we call an act of devotion. That's what devotion is. I see what God made.
Or an act I made. Act of devotion or an act of transcendence? The experience of transcendence?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what we mean by transcendence. We didn't discuss that. But somehow, I am fulfilling my obligation. And when you fulfill your obligation to God, certainly that brings you closer to God, and not, you know, if you throw garbage all over the park, so you're going to hide when the park commissioner comes around. But if you plant tulips, you know, you'll happily stand there while he appreciates, you know, what you've done.
That's the creative act. What about the appreciation of the creative?
No, but it's not just a creative act in the sense that you make something that's never been made before, but beauty becomes a measure of the creative act. You can't just do whatever you want. You have to do something that has beauty in it, because that's the way God created the world.
No, like what about the appreciation of beauty? That's for the, you're talking about the artists and the tulip planters, but what about
I think it devolves to
every... Cook didn't paint the Rembrandt. He said, I'm 200 years, 300 years after Rembrandt, and I'm looking at it, and...
Well, that's what we do. We appreciate God's world, and we can appreciate the addition that man makes to God's world.
Mm-hmm.
That's a special capacity that I have. Not only can I build an addition to God's world, but I can appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a wonderful still life, so what is a, you know, you have a couple of apples and pears and a knife and a cloth hanging down off the table. So really, it's all there in the world that God created, and yet it's not there. It was invented in that still life.
And on the contrary, if you pass that scene 100 times a day in the real world, you see a few apples, a pear, a chopped off fish head, you know, I'm thinking of some other famous still lives,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't really look at it twice.
Hmm.
But when...
Well, that's what beauty does. Right? Beauty is, attracts you. It attracts you, you know, again and again. To the same.
No, but in other words, but the...
Like your Scottish Highlands.
The value added of seeing it on the canvas instead of seeing it in your own kitchen. You know, you see that in your own kitchen, you might be agitated that someone, you know, left that mess on the table. But you see it on the canvas, what you're appreciating is the creative act that, whether it's transcendent or sublime or exalted, we can niggle over the term. That's what we're appreciating.
But it's important to recognize that the mess on the table is a mess, whereas the creation on the canvas is something that doesn't exist on anybody's table.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely different. The colors are different. The arrangement is different. The way the artist attracts you to the picture is different. This is a creation. It's not an accident. It's not something in the world that fell apart like a bunch of fruit on your kitchen table. But it's something that is constructed. I mean, even if the fruit in the picture is not all in the bowl, but it's a construction. And that construction is a creation, and that creation, in order to attract me, has to give me the sense of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
That's what connects me to that creation. So it's a creation. It's man doing something that ordinarily he can't do. He can't make a pear because it was already made, but you could arrange a pear in a way that it's never been arranged before. So that's what I think. So he feels that if a person does this religious act, he's connecting to creation through beauty, so that, as all religious acts, has an effect on the world in which we live, because then there's a demand, of course, for more beauty. As you, when you build, say, beautiful buildings, so then you want to build more beautiful buildings, I guess. But if you live in a hut where there are no buildings at all, the desire is kind of minimized.
Yeah.
So that's a way of defining a religious activity. It creates shock, in a ripple effect in the world around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think what Rav Kook is pointing to.
Yeah, I think your example of maps is a nice way of putting out what Rav Kook's saying. Rav Kook's saying that when you touch that quality of beauty, you're tapping into some kind of underlying order in creation. Sidur HaChayim, he says, and that's mathematicians get very excited about that sense that you can, you know, they just touch something essential about the structure of creation through this mathematical formula. And that creating beauty is a matter of continuing that underlying order which you've appreciated in the world. You know, you think of those Renaissance scientists, mathematicians who figured out that, you know, they looked at plants and animals and that they saw that the golden ratio, 1.6, whatever it was all over the place. And that somehow a lot of things had been created with that pattern in mind. And then they started using that in their buildings and cathedrals, and because, you know, if you can take that structure which HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to have put into nature and continue it in the things that we built, then you're going to be creating things that are beautiful. That's very, very much what you're saying about.
I think that you're right. I just think you left out the point that order and beauty seem to be synonyms.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
In other words, when you see the order, you call it beauty. That's all the name we give it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a certain visceral aspect to it. You know,
mm-hmm.
And it's true even about a building, which may be built as a built formally to perform some function.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we could differentiate for ourselves
mm-hmm.
a building that makes you feel that everything is in order and everything is in place, and that the neighborhood is growing properly, for a building that just mm-hmm. disorients everything and mm-hmm. makes you feel like everything is misplaced.
Mm-hmm.
So that the former is called beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you could call it order, but order is not a tough enough word.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we understand that when Rav Kook says order, I mean order, you know, since the Maharal was a very,
mm-hmm.
was the word that had a lot of, that meant creation, right? There was an order in creation, there's day one and then day two. Day three, mm-hmm. so we have to look for order. We spend all the time looking for order.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that order equals beauty equals religious experience is an idea that's not necessarily obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not from the Maharal. And A. Rav Kook is
mm-hmm.
connecting to that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
That's what I mentioned earlier, that I had recently read Walter Benjamin's very famous essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. So that essay, which might be Benjamin's most famous essay, which is really discussing, you know, the role of film and photography, but he mentioned this idea of, at least traditionally, and certainly we've been talking, you know, about very traditional types of art, traditionally a great work of art, or any work of art, is invested with some type of what he called aura. I don't know what he called it in German, but in English translation it's called the aura of the work. And that's what draws us to the work of art. The example he gives is, of course, the Mona Lisa. But even though the Mona Lisa is the most, probably the most viewed object in the world, people still line up every day in Paris, 1,000 people a day line up in Paris to go see the real thing. Because they understand that being in the presence of the authentic thing is brings you into contact with that aura, and the aura comes from realizing that there's something absolutely unique about this object. And then he discusses in the age of mechanical reproduction, the age of photography, it's no longer relevant to talk about the original object. There is no original object. There's no value to the whole discussion breaks down. Then he talks about what is the meaning of that. But that idea of the aura is, I think, fits in with this idea. That's the created. You know, there's an aura in creation itself, in natural creation. But in artistic creation, there's also that. I'm not sure that aura translates as tiferet, but a little bit, there's some kind of overlap here between these ideas. And that's what we're appreciating, and that's what might generate the experience of, you know, the tzaddik artist can create an artwork with greater aura, and the careful observer of the art, the careful appreciator of the art, can use that aura to enhance his or her own fill in the blank with the set of values that we've been discussing all these many weeks that are contributions to the religious personality. Mm-hmm. Wonder, deep seeing, being aware, being alive in a sense that you are open to the aesthetic and the original meaning again of the sensual, that your senses are open, they're not blocked. They're open to the inputs of uniqueness. And that's, I think, part of the religious quest, is an appreciation and awareness of the absolutely unique, the absolutely unique in creation, the absolutely unique in ourselves, in others, in intellectual thought, to be mechadesh, and that might be the tool here that we're trying to activate in art. This is what I think. I'm not certain this is what Rav Kook is saying.
Yeah. This is vaguely connected to what you're saying. I was just reading yesterday that for Rosenzweig, one of the important things about his experience of God is that God has a name. God isn't just God, but God has a unique name and therefore has a unique relationship with him. You can't paraphrase it, you can't describe it, you can't describe God's name as something else. God's name is just God's name. It's something you have to try and have a relationship to, but it's unique, and it's nothing else other than itself. Maybe that's related to what you were saying.
If I could make a one more comment, you mentioned also there was earlier a mention of Rav Kook in the National Gallery, and Rav Kook was looking at Rembrandt, and Rembrandt drew pictures of natural scenes, either people or groups of people, and yet Rav Kook abstracted the Rembrandt into light. We all know that light is very important for Rembrandt and that school of painting, but it's not obvious that someone would look at a painting of Rembrandt and say, it's a light. Right? And that
instead of saying it's
a picture of the militia in the night watch, you know, and there's also a very interesting use of light in depicting the people. So that Rav Kook immediately somehow jumped over the idea that the picture was a picture of something, and he got right to the light, he got to the abstract, and it took several hundred years of painting until people would paint pictures of light or of dark or of, you know, very in the modernistic sense, but Rav Kook saw that they were looking for the spiritual moment They had to encase it in real, right? Mm-hmm. Just like Olam Hazeh.
Mm-hmm.
And the moderns wanted to somehow break through that limitation of having to put people in the picture in order to really paint the beauty of Olam Hazeh, which approaches Olam Haba. Last week, I was in the Tate Modern. And you know, there's a room in the Tate
in
Modern in London that I was in the, there's a room, there's a Rothko room. Rothko made this series of paintings, which he then found out were going to be in a restaurant or something, and he went berserk. So they ended up in the Tate Modern. I mean, Rothko paints colors that he largely invents, and they have very, they don't have well-defined boundaries. You know, his paintings don't have boundaries, both on the painting and at the edge of the paintings. They don't usually have well-defined boundaries. So he's painting colors and limitlessness. And certainly one could feel, that looking at Rothko sort of is an experience that is different. It's not like walking in Leicester Square. It's something, it's a different world. I mean, your mind is connected to things that it ordinarily is not connected to. So there was a certain kind of achievement from Rembrandt, who had to draw people in order to draw the light, to Rothko, who was able to just draw the idea, but not to encumber it with Olam Hazeh, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that this breakthrough that Rav Kook imagines that the tzaddikim were able to make between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, Olam HaShamayim,
mm-hmm.
is something that kind of happened not only in that painting of Rembrandt, but in the history or the development of painting, perhaps.
Mm.
If you look at painting as an idea and not as a history of an idea rather than the history of, of painting.
Before we end, since we've been talking about it, I'll just mention that I just started reading what so far seems to be a very interesting book called Rembrandt's Jews by Stephen Nadler, N-A-D-L-E-R, who teaches at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he comes to the field through Jewish studies, not through art, but since so much of Rembrandt's work obviously deals with portraits of Jews, portraits of Jewish scenes, of biblical scenes, of Old Testament scenes. So a lot of, you know, he kind of tries to explore this notion of Rembrandt's special affinity or connection to the Jewish people. Certainly Rembrandt in mid-17th century Amsterdam lived in the Jewish quarter, and he explores this. It's both art history, social history, Jewish history, and it's so far very interesting book with a lot of very nice color illustrations, and perhaps we'll come back to it at some point.
Sounds good.
In the meantime, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next installment, where we will continue our conversations on Rav Kook's teachings and how they relate to Jewish life, learning, and creativity.
That was good. Enjoyable.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.